hemorrhaging throughout the body has begun. To date, no viral infection has been demonstrated to be resistant to the proper dosing of vitamin C as classically demonstrated by Klenner. However, not all viruses have been treated with Klenner-sized vitamin C doses, or at least the results have not been published. Ebola viral infection and the other acute viral hemorrhagic fevers appear to be diseases that fall into this category. Because of the seemingly exceptional ability of these viruses to rapidly deplete vitamin C stores, even larger doses of vitamin C would likely be required in order to effectively reverse and eventually cure infections caused by these viruses. Cathcart, who introduced the concept of bowel tolerance to vitamin C discussed earlier, hypothesized that Ebola and the other acute viral hemorrhagic fevers may well require 500,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily to reach bowel tolerance. It would be very interesting to examine the effects of oral liposome encapsulated vitamin C on these rapidly progressing viral syndromes. Whether this estimate is accurate, it seems clear, as evidenced by the scurvy-like clinical manifestations of these infections, that vitamin C dosing must be vigorous and given in extremely high doses. If the disease seems to be winning, then even more vitamin C should be given until symptoms begin to lessen. Obviously, these are viral diseases that would adequately require high doses of vitamin C intravenously as the initial therapy. The oral administration should begin simultaneously, but the intravenous route should not be abandoned until the clinical response is complete. Death occurs too quickly with the hemorrhagic fevers to be conservative when dosing the vitamin C. Belfield and Stone reported enormous success in the treatment of a variety of viral infections in animals, emphasizing that they had found no virus to be unresponsive to intravenous vitamin C. Specifically with regard to viral diseases, they asserted, the intravenous use of ascorbate, vitamin C, is especially valuable in the therapy of the viral diseases as it appears to be an effective, non-specific, non-toxic, virucidal agent. We have not seen any viral disease that did not respond to this treatment. Successful therapy appears to depend on using it in sufficiently large doses. The experience of Belfield and Stone with vitamin C and viral infections in animals certainly seems to agree with the phenomenal success that Klenner reported in his treatment of viral infections with vitamin C in humans. It also implies that Ebola viral infection and the other acute viral hemorrhagic fevers should respond to large enough doses of intravenous vitamin C. Another viral disease that has the capability of producing Ebola-like hemorrhagic complications is smallpox. Akin to chickenpox, but much more deadly, smallpox has probably killed approximately 100 million people throughout history. Not surprisingly, smallpox has historically been the most deadly in those populations of people who have the poorest nutritional status and, logically, the lowest body reservoirs of vitamin C. Although no direct evidence of the effects of vitamin C on the smallpox virus could be found in the literature, the virus in the smallpox vaccine is readily killed by vitamin C. This virus, known as the vaccinia virus, is related closely enough to the smallpox virus that inoculation with it will typically produce an immunity to smallpox. However, this fortunate similarity between vaccinia and smallpox virus prevents the need for direct inoculation with some weakened or attenuated form of smallpox virus, eliminating the chance of an accidental smallpox infection. Kligler and Bernkopf and Turner found that this related vaccinia virus was easily killed by relatively small amounts of vitamin C. They noted that the degree of viral inactivation depended on the vitamin C concentration and time period it was in contact with the virus. These studies were done shortly after Jungeblut had demonstrated that vitamin C could similarly inactivate the polio virus. All of this research represented initial efforts to show the wide-ranging ability of vitamin C to neutralize and or kill different microbes. Although the vaccinia virus is not the smallpox virus, all of the evidence presented so far would argue strongly that enough vitamin C, properly administered, should control and cure smallpox as readily as any other of the deadly viral syndromes. For those who still fear that the Ebola virus is the untreatable disease just waiting to strike down their perfect health, consider the recently published evidence that indicates a symptom-free Ebola infection can and does occur in human beings. Leroy et al. Looked at a number of individuals who were in direct contact with patients sick with Ebola, but who had never developed symptoms. Evidence in the blood testing of these patients revealed that a strong inflammatory response early in the course of the infectious process had taken place, and that roughly half of the symptom-free group also developed Ebola virus-specific antibodies. All of this evidence lends further support to the notion that encountering the Ebola virus does not mean instant death. It is also highly unlikely that Ebola virus could successfully sicken an individual with a good general nutritional status and who is taking a daily bowel tolerance dosage of vitamin C or a reasonable daily dose of liposome encapsulated vitamin C. Non-viral infectious diseases and vitamin C. Diphtheria, curable and preventable. Diphtheria is an acute bacterial infectious disease that is most commonly found in infants and children. Diphtheria usually affects primarily the upper respiratory tract, where a tough membrane will typically cover the most affected tissues. In fact, the word diphtheria literally means leather hide, referring to how notoriously tough this characteristic membrane is. The infecting organism, a gram-positive bacillus, also produces a potentially lethal toxin that can spread rapidly to the heart, the nerves, and/or the kidneys. Diphtheria is one of several infectious diseases that produces illness both from the primary infection and from the production of a disease-specific toxin. Vitamin C is especially appropriate for the treatment of a disease like diphtheria, since it is uniquely capable of both eradicating the infection and neutralizing the associated toxin without any significant toxicity of its own. Over the past few decades, diphtheria has continued to have a case fatality rate that runs between 5% and 10%. The primary traditional treatment for this infection is a horse serum-derived antitoxin, along with antibiotics such as penicillin, erythromycin, or clindamycin. Immediate allergic reactions to the antitoxin have an overall incidence of 15%. In older children, a syndrome called serum sickness can follow the use of the antitoxin in 20 to 30% of the cases. This will typically last an additional 1 to 2 weeks, featuring joint inflammation and further fever. Furthermore, there can also be a significant adverse reaction or side effect from any of the antibiotics given. Klenner also had a great deal of success in treating diphtheria with vitamin C. He was quite emphatic, however, that massive, frequent doses of vitamin C needed to be given intravenously or intramuscularly. Generally, when the patient was 4 years of age or older, Klenner would opt for an intravenous administration if at all possible. This intravenous route was used whenever the child seemed ill enough, regardless of the diagnosis. In treating diphtheria, Klenner specifically noted that giving only 1,000 to 2,000 milligrams of vitamin C orally every 2 hours typically produced little response. However, he asserted that curing diphtheria was routine if enough vitamin C was given by vein or in the muscle. Klenner later declared that he had witnessed the clearing of diphtheria, hemolytic streptococcus, and staphylococcus infections within hours when a vitamin C dose range of 500 to 700 milligrams per body weight was given intravenously and allowed to run through a 20-gauge needle as fast as the patient's cardiovascular system would allow. Antitoxin was not needed, since vitamin C, as will be discussed at length in Chapter 3, is also the ultimate toxin neutralizer or inactivator. Vitamin C negates the effects of a wider variety of toxic poisonings than any other known agent by far. This is another reason why vitamin C is exceptionally well suited to treat diphtheria, as well as other infectious diseases that produce not only specific toxins, but also less well-identified toxic byproducts that result from both the metabolism of the microbe and its interactions with the host. Multiple German investigators all documented beneficial results from the treatment of diphtheria with vitamin C. Klenner also noted that the tough membrane that adhered to the most affected tissues in the throat tended to gradually decompose as the disease responded to the vitamin C, rather than break off more suddenly when the antitoxin was used. He also commented that diphtheria could be cured in about half the time normally needed to remove the membrane with the antitoxin treatment. McCormick commented on the bleeding tendencies seen in diphtheria, and he also noted the association between scurvy and a proneness to hemorrhage. Any infectious disease that also produces a potent toxin can be expected to even more rapidly and completely deplete vitamin C stores, and bleeding from different sites can be expected from this acutely induced state of scurvy if vitamin C is not quickly and generously administered. Diphtheria patients are prone to easy nosebleeds, and when the membrane is removed, it is not uncommon to see profuse bleeding. McCormick also noted that diphtheria in 18th century Central and Northern Europe was an especially dreaded disease, with about an 80% case fatality rate. He attributed this to the prevalence of widespread vitamin C depletion from the lack of fresh fruits available at that time. Klenner also reported on three children living in the same neighborhood with nasal diphtheria, which specifically affects the nasal lining and produces a characteristic bloody discharge from the nose. In nasal diphtheria, the membrane will develop in this area rather than in the throat. All three children had different doctors. The little girl under Klenner's care was given 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C as a slow intravenous push with a 50 cc syringe every 8 hours for the first 24 hours, and then every 12 hours for two or more doses. Following this, she was given 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C every 2 hours by mouth. Klenner also notes that a 40,000-unit dose of antitoxin was injected into the little girl's abdomen. The other two children received the antitoxin as well, but they did not receive any vitamin C. They both died, but Klenner's patient survived, later becoming a nurse. The outstanding clinical success of Klenner in treating diphtheria with vitamin C was supported by some impressive basic research reported in the 1930s. Hard and Philippe demonstrated that lethal doses of diphtheria toxin pre-mixed with vitamin C were no longer lethal in the guinea pigs they injected. The toxin doses without the vitamin C killed the guinea pigs in 4 to 8 days. Jungeblut and Zwemme found that vitamin C inactivated diphtheria toxin in the test tube and also helped to protect many of the guinea pigs against the fatal outcome of being injected with diphtheria toxin. The authors concluded that vitamin C played an important role in the mechanism of natural resistance to diphtheria toxin. Greenwald and Hard were also able to demonstrate that vitamin C could increase the resistance of guinea pigs to injections of standardized diphtheria toxin. Furthermore, they demonstrated that mixtures of toxin and vitamin C had less toxicity than pure toxin upon injection. Hanslick and Torada, stimulated to further investigate the work of the two research groups just mentioned, found that about 50% of pigeons infected with fatal doses of diphtheria toxin survived when given a single 100 milligram intramuscular injection of vitamin C. They also found that pigeons injected with toxin pre-mixed with vitamin C all survived. They concluded that vitamin C was a legitimate inactivator of diphtheria toxin. Seagal and King looked at the effect that vitamin C has in lessening the negative impact of diphtheria toxin on glucose, sugar, metabolism in guinea pigs. Compared to animals receiving larger doses, these researchers were able to demonstrate that sublethal injections of toxin did cause greater metabolic disturbances in animals receiving only enough vitamin C to prevent scurvy. This conclusion was especially significant since it demonstrated that the healthiest dose of vitamin C was clearly in excess of the tiny amount capable only of preventing scurvy. Similarly, King and Menton were able to demonstrate that actual survival times for scurvy-stricken guinea pigs infected with diphtheria were only half that of normal control animals. This finding was consistent with the fact that the guinea pig cannot manufacture any vitamin C for itself. On the other hand, the mouse is a vitamin C synthesizing research animal that has a natural resistance to diphtheria. Kligler et al. Looked at the effects of vitamin C on growing cultures of diphtheria bacteria as opposed to purified diphtheria toxin. They found that a given amount of vitamin C has a specific effect in reducing the toxicity of diphtheria cultures. However, they could not clearly determine the mechanism utilized by vitamin C in reducing the toxicity of the cultures. They suggested that vitamin C could be either affecting the metabolism of the bacteria to stop producing toxin, or that vitamin C could be modifying or destroying the toxin as rapidly as it was formed. Another researcher, von Gagy, found that enough vitamin C added to the cultures of diphtheria bacteria in an acidic medium could kill the bacteria within 6 hours of exposure. Pachter and Schick put together a good review of much of this early information concerning the effects of vitamin C on diphtheria and its associated toxin. The incredible clinical success that Klenner had in treating diphtheria with vitamin C, along with early laboratory evidence looking at the interactions of vitamin C and diphtheria, clearly shows that diphtheria is a disease that can be readily cured with properly dosed and administered vitamin C. Because diphtheria is both an infectious disease and a producer of a severe toxin, vitamin C should be given initially by vein or in the muscle prior to settling on any oral dosage regimen. Also, as with any other infectious disease curable by vitamin C, maintenance dosing up to bowel tolerance should be highly effective in preventing diphtheria from ever being contracted. A much smaller daily dose of liposome-encapsulated vitamin C should also prove to be a highly effective preventative therapy. Pertussis. Reversible and preventable. Curable? Question mark. Pertussis, commonly known as whooping cough, is a bacterial respiratory illness that occurs most commonly and most severely in infants and young children. The common name derives from the sound of the prolonged, distressed efforts to take a breath that follows repeated coughing. Even today, pertussis is estimated to cause 500,000 deaths yearly, primarily in infants. Antibiotic treatment of this disease is primarily directed at rendering the patient non-infectious to others. Even when the microbes are eliminated by antibiotics in an infected infant, the remaining course of the illness is typically unaltered. Pertussis is somewhat prolonged, with an incubation stage of 1 to 2 weeks characterized by fever, runny nose, and cough. The severe phase of the illness, with the frightening episodes of coughing and whooping, lasts another 3 to 4 weeks. The convalescent stage, marked by a slow recovery with a gradually lessened frequency of whooping episodes, can last another 4 to 12 weeks. Following this final stage for many more months, even a mild, unrelated respiratory infection can induce a return of the characteristic pertussis cough and whoop. Pertussis is also another disease with an associated toxin, even though no traditional antitoxin treatments have been developed for it. However, the pertussis toxin is not considered to have the severe, body-wide effect of the diphtheria toxin. Unfortunately, no evidence could be found indicating that Klenner had the opportunity to treat pertussis. Other investigators and clinicians have had some success in treating pertussis with vitamin C, but it has been qualified by the use of significantly smaller doses than would have been used by Klenner. However, as should be apparent from the evidence already reviewed, there is no good reason to believe that Klenner-sized doses of vitamin C would not be as effective in the treatment of pertussis as in the treatment of so many other infectious diseases. Otani found that pertussis bacteria seem to be especially susceptible to the effects of vitamin C in the test tube, with a high enough dose to have a killing bactericidal effect. It was also demonstrated that a culture of pertussis bacteria, in which vitamin C had been added, possessed a strongly reduced inefficacy in test animals. Furthermore, when the vitamin C-treated bacteria were injected by vein into test animals, a lessened white blood cell response resulted. Most likely, this was an indication that the treated bacteria were less infectious and toxic than the untreated bacteria. Because of these results, Otani proceeded to use vitamin C in the treatment of children with pertussis. Otani's treatment ranged from 50 to 200 milligrams of vitamin C once or twice daily, and total injections ranged from 5 to 12. Otani reported that in 81 patients treated in this fashion, 34 showed a clear improvement of symptoms or perfect healing, 32 showed a lesser symptom improvement, and 15 showed an indeterminate response. It appears that Otani got fairly dramatic responses in many pertussis patients with vitamin C doses well below what Klenner would have routinely used. It would also seem that the neutralizing effect that vitamin C has on pertussis toxin is an additional reason why symptoms responded so well to its administration, since eliminating the bacteria with antibiotics has long been noted not to affect the duration or severity of the clinical illness. One hypothesis, advanced by Brown, is that the symptoms of pertussis are prolonged because the pertussis toxin becomes bound to the nervous tissue that involves the mucous membranes of the respiratory tract, thereby maintaining a prolonged irritability. Otani later reported on the treatment of 109 pertussis cases. He found some efficiency to remarkable efficiency in over 80% of the patients treated. Some of the less responsive patients had had additional infections or other medical complications that would be expected to require increased amounts of vitamin C in order to show a good clinical response. Ormerid and Unkauf also reported on the treatment of pertussis with vitamin C. They found that vitamin C definitely shortens the severest symptoms of pertussis, particularly if relatively large doses are used shortly after the first symptoms of the disease appear. 9 children and 1 adult were treated. The oral dosing was somewhat minimal, ranging from 150 to 500 milligrams of vitamin C daily over an 8-day to 15-day period. Waringer and Sala had earlier reported that in a number of infants seen for pertussis in their clinic, 4 of them developed scurvy as a result of their infections. This is further evidence that the combination of infection and toxicity is an especially effective way to rapidly and completely deplete the body's limited stores of vitamin C. It is also an important additional reason to add vitamin C therapy to the treatment of any infectious disease, regardless of cause. A recurring theme throughout this book is that infection and stress of any sort will significantly increase the rate at which vitamin C is metabolized and utilized. As a result, unrecognized acute scurvy is a relatively common complication of many fatal diseases, infectious or otherwise. Ormerid et al., in following up the earlier work just mentioned, presented their results on the treatment of 17 more cases of pertussis with oral doses of vitamin C. Although they acknowledged the likely superiority of giving vitamin C by vein, they especially wanted to evaluate the oral route, since it would provide a less expensive treatment with wider applicability. The oral schedule was a prolonged, tapered regimen. A 350 milligram dose of vitamin C was given on the first day, and on subsequent days, 250, 250, 200, 200, 150, 150, 125, 125, and finally 100 milligrams were given. A 100 milligram daily dose was then maintained until there was a complete remission of symptoms for 2 days. The average total dose ended up being about 2,700 milligrams. This vitamin C treatment protocol was found to markedly decrease the intensity, frequency, and length of the characteristic pertussis symptoms. Vermilion and Stafford reported on the vitamin C treatment of 26 infants and small children with pertussis. They appeared to be particularly interested in trying to duplicate the earlier work of Otani, Ormerod, Unkauf, and White. The first 16 patients were treated with 150 milligrams of oral vitamin C daily for the first 3 days. Then, 120 milligrams daily was given for the next 3 days, and finally 90 milligrams daily was given until symptoms entirely subsided. The remaining patients were given comparable but variable oral doses of vitamin C. The researchers concluded that vitamin C appeared to be strikingly effective in the relief symptoms in all but 2 patients. They further concluded that vitamin C should be given in all cases of pertussis, regardless of patient age or the length of time elapsed since the onset of symptoms. 2 other researchers who utilized injectable vitamin C in treating infants with pertussis also reported success in controlling the disease symptoms. Sessa reported that injecting 100 to 500 milligrams of vitamin C daily appeared to reduce the convulsive coughing and accelerate the overall rate of recovery. Meyer, using both injectable and oral doses of vitamin C, found that coughing was reduced with a quicker restoration of appetite and disappearance of vomiting. The benefit appeared to be especially pronounced in injected infants. The evidence clearly supports a beneficial role for vitamin C in the treatment of pertussis. Doses probably adequate to achieve a complete and rapid cure, as used routinely by Klenner in other infectious diseases, were not found in the literature for the treatment of pertussis. However, much smaller doses consistently had positive effects in lessening both the intensity and duration of symptoms, and often the duration of the illness was also clearly shortened. The bacteria causing pertussis can be killed in culture by vitamin C, and the effects of the pertussis toxin also appear to be lessened by vitamin C. Furthermore, scurvy has been shown to be precipitated by pertussis infection. Vitamin C needs to be administered in pertussis and all infectious diseases, and adequate regular dosing of vitamin C should prevent pertussis from ever being contracted. It remains to be seen what Klenner-sized doses of vitamin C would do for the acutely infected pertussis patient. Tetanus, curable and preventable. Tetanus is an acute bacterial infectious disease that results in an often fatal neurological syndrome. The primary clinical manifestations of tetanus are caused by the extremely potent neurotoxin that is produced by the germinating spores of the bacteria causing the infection, known as Clostridium tetani. The neurotoxin, known as tetanospasmin, is among the most potent toxins known to man, including botulism toxin. 1 milligram of tetanospasmin is capable of killing 50 to 70 million mice. Symptoms of this toxin come from the progressive muscular spasms that can eventually evolve to seizures, respiratory difficulty, and paralysis. Tetanus is traditionally treated with a combination of antibiotics, tetanus antitoxin, and tetanus toxoid immunization. The tetanus toxoid is given to induce antibodies that neutralize newly produced toxin not yet bound to target tissues. As tetanus typically comes from deep physical wounds that allow the oxygen-deprived bacteria to germinate and multiply, local wound cleaning and care is also important in the proper treatment of this infection. Klenner felt the need to dispel the general belief that tetanus was a difficult disease to cure. He was also convinced that tetanus antitoxin had no curative value and was actually harmful, especially when given frequently by Vane. Klenner described the case of a 6-year-old boy who was already demonstrating toxin-related symptoms and muscle spasms when he first saw the child. The child could not open his mouth more than 30% due to jaw spasm, and a sudden involuntary clamping of the jaws shut, lockjaw, would follow any attempt to open his mouth. Vital signs revealed a low-grade temperature, rapid and shallow breathing, and a rapid pulse, ranging from 120 to 130 per minute. In addition to vitamin C, Klenner also used a skeletal muscle relaxant known as Tolsterol to prevent convulsive seizures and help relieve the muscle spasms. Klenner also noted that the antitoxin therapy administered to this child was the result of outside pressure and not his decision. All vitamin C was given intravenously to this patient. During the first 24 hours, a total of 22,000 milligrams of vitamin C was given in multiple doses, ranging from 3 to 5 hours apart. A total of 24,000 milligrams of vitamin C was given over the next 24 hours. Throughout these first 2 days, the child was taking progressively more nutrition and was bothered with only mild abdominal cramps. Over the next 2 days, comparable amounts of vitamin C were given, but 5 separate doses of tetanus antitoxin were also given intravenously. After each dose of antitoxin, the child deteriorated clinically with severe abdominal pain and initially a reactivation of fever. Intermittent doses of penicillin and calcium gluconate were also given. Much of the child's discomfort was alleviated by the Tolsterol. Ultimately, the child was discharged on the 18th hospital day, although Klenner felt the child could have been safely discharged 10 days earlier. Klenner was very convinced that the antitoxin actually continued to compromise health rather than improve it. While no other cases of tetanus treated by Klenner could be found in the literature, he did comment on the tetanus case of an adult white female who died from the inability to breathe less than 1 hour after receiving a single intravenous dose of tetanus antitoxin. Undoubtedly, this also affected Klenner's attitude toward antitoxin. He did feel that a single intramuscular rather than intravenous dose of antitoxin above a wound suspected to be the site of the infecting tetanus bacteria was reasonable for the purpose of dealing more effectively at the presumed site where the new toxin was being formed. When considering the response of Klenner's tetanus-infected child described earlier, it should be kept in mind that the overall mortality for generalized tetanus is 20 to 25% with even the best modern medical care. Furthermore, those who do survive will generally require from 3 to 6 weeks for complete recovery. Jahan et al. Conducted a simple study on the effects of vitamin C in the treatment of tetanus. In 13 tetanus patients aged from 1 to 12 years, a daily intravenous vitamin C administration of 1,000 milligrams was given in addition to antitoxin. Although none of the vitamin C-treated patients died, almost 75% of those who did not receive the vitamin C did. In older patients, aged from 13 to 30 years, 68% of those not receiving vitamin C died, while only 37% of those who received the vitamin C expired. Undoubtedly, larger doses of vitamin C would have completely protected the older group as well. The need for vitamin C is directly proportional to the size of one's body. A 1,000 milligram dose of intravenous vitamin C goes a lot further in an infant or small child than in a much larger teenager or adult. One very impressive animal study on tetanus toxicity strongly supports Klenner's conviction that antitoxin treatment is, at best, unnecessary, and that vitamin C alone should remedy the condition without any resulting toxicity. Day studied the effects of vitamin C on the toxicity of twice the minimum lethal dose of tetanus toxin injected into rats. There were 5 groups of rats. Group 1 was given only the tetanus toxin. Group 2 received toxin and intra-abdominal vitamin C simultaneously, followed by more vitamin C for 3 more days. Group 3 received vitamin C first for 3 days, then was dosed with the toxin, and vitamin C was continued for 3 more days. Group 4 was given the toxin, and the symptoms of local tetanus were allowed to develop over the next 16 to 26 hours. Vitamin C was then initiated and continued for 3 days. Group 5 was given the toxin, and the symptoms of generalized severe tetanus were allowed to develop over the next 40 to 47 hours. Intravenous vitamin C, rather than intra-abdominal, was then given. Except for Group 1 animals, which received toxin and no vitamin C, all animals survived. Group 1 animals died from 47 to 65 hours after the toxin administration. In the Group 2 survivors, some very mild local tetanus symptoms were seen in the affected legs. In Group 3 survivors, which also received vitamin C before the toxin was given, there were no symptoms of toxicity. The Group 4 survivors had no further spread of the initial symptoms. No symptom description was given for the Group 5 survivors. What does this experiment mean? One reasonable conclusion is that totally non-toxic vitamin C dosages can completely neutralize fatal amounts of tetanus toxin in an animal model. There was no need for the administration of any antitoxin to help in reaching this outcome. Day had earlier demonstrated that vitamin C was most effective as a prophylactic and a therapeutic agent in negating the lethal and convulsive properties of strychnine, an agent that produces a clinical syndrome very similar to that produced by tetanus toxin. Furthermore, adequate doses of vitamin C given prior to tetanus toxin administration proved to be completely protective in preventing any manifestation of toxin effect. Also, considering the rat is an animal that can produce its own vitamin C, this experiment gives even greater support for the vigorous treatment of suspected tetanus infection with vitamin C. Animals producing vitamin C can still get sick from tetanus or any other infectious disease if enough of a microbe challenge and or microbe-associated toxicity confronts them. Humans, with no inherent vitamin C-producing abilities, need the prompt high dosing of vitamin C in the face of such challenges to survive the infection and minimize the toxic effects. Some earlier research suggested the likelihood that the positive clinical effects noted would occur in the treatment of tetanus-stricken patients. Jungablut demonstrated that vitamin C could inactivate tetanus toxin in the test tube. Prior to the isolation and commercial availability of vitamin C, Imamura demonstrated that ovarian follicular fluid could inactivate tetanus toxin as well. It is now known that such fluid contains a high concentration of vitamin C. Kligler et al. Found that vitamin C added to growing cultures of tetanus bacteria reduced the toxicity of those cultures in proportion to the amount of vitamin C added. The authors also found that the vitamin C added to purified tetanus toxin neutralized the toxin, with the degree of neutralization depending upon temperature, vitamin C concentration, and the time of vitamin C exposure. More recently, Eller et al. Looked at the abilities of vitamin C to kill the spores of a number of different bacteria in the genus Clostridium, including the spores of the bacteria responsible for botulism and its enormous toxicity. The botulism bacteria are in the same genus as those of tetanus bacteria. Not only did the researchers demonstrate that vitamin C would kill the bacterial spores in a dose-dependent fashion, they also noted that vitamin C did not appear to provoke the toxin-releasing state of spore germination, which a large number of diverse compounds will induce. The totality of the evidence would indicate that vitamin C is an ideal agent for the treatment of patients infected with the tetanus microbe. The tetanus toxin appears to be neutralized by vitamin C in the body, in laboratory animals, and in the test tube. A significant amount of the sickness related to a tetanus infection can come from antitoxin, one of its standard treatments. Undoubtedly, fatal reactions to this antitoxin still occur, and some of these deaths end up being blamed on the tetanus toxin itself and not on its antitoxin treatment. Fortunately, vitamin C does not share this toxicity. While the volume of evidence documenting a vitamin C cure for tetanus is limited, it would certainly appear that tetanus is another infectious, toxic disease that vitamin C can cure, reverse, and prevent. It should also be noted that the last three diseases addressed, diphtheria, pertussis, and tetanus, are the same three diseases targeted by the DPT, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, vaccinations, routinely administered to infants in the United States and across the world. Many individual reports of adverse reactions to this vaccine have been reported, including encephalopathy with permanent brain damage and sometimes autism. Vaccinations also generally present some degree of toxin insult to the body. Kelikarinos observed that vitamin C deficient aboriginal infants were often pushed into an acute state of scurvy because of the additional vitamin C demands placed on their bodies by the vaccination injections, resulting in sudden death. Kelikarinos was also able to determine that regular administrations of vitamin C would prevent sudden death and eliminate many of the toxic effects associated with vaccination. The work of Kelikarinos argues strongly that sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, is often a complication of too many vaccinations given over too short a time and injected into bodies that are just too small to cope with the cumulative toxic insult. However, regardless of the actual frequency of such vaccination complications, it is important to keep in mind that the proper use of vitamin C would probably completely prevent any need, perceived or otherwise, to vaccinate against these diseases at all. It is doubtful that there are any diseases for which vaccinations are presently administered that will not be easily prevented and or cured by the optimal dosing of vitamin C. No negative outcomes following a vaccination will ever occur if no vaccination is ever given. However, if you must receive a vaccination, the toxicity is greatly lessened and the desired immune response definitely enhanced by giving generous doses of vitamin C before and after the vaccination. Tuberculosis, reversible and preventable, curable, question mark. Tuberculosis is an infectious disease caused by a type of bacteria called Mycobacterium tuberculosis. Tuberculosis bacteria, known as Mycobacteria, are characterized by a slower rate of growth than is seen with many other types of bacteria. Accordingly, tuberculosis is a chronic disease, developing slowly and responding slowly to treatment when compared with the acute and rapidly developing syndrome seen with many of the other infectious diseases. Although tuberculosis can involve many different organs and tissues in the body, the classic form predominantly features the infectious involvement of the lungs. Worldwide, tuberculosis is the leading infectious cause of both illness and death. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that about 33% of the world's population is latently infected with tuberculosis, and from this reservoir, approximately 8 to 10 million new and active cases of tuberculosis develop each year. Of these cases, about half are the more readily communicable pulmonary, lung, forms of tuberculosis. The symptoms of pulmonary tuberculosis include a cough that progresses to cough-produced secretions streaked with blood. Often bright red blood alone is coughed up, and night sweats with variable amounts of fever can also be seen. Standard medical therapy usually involves two or more drugs to which a patient's infecting strain of tuberculosis bacteria proves to be sensitive. Drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis have become relatively common. No reports could be found of Klenner or any other researchers treating tuberculosis with Klenner's uniquely high amounts of vitamin C. However, without further qualification, Klenner did assert that massive daily doses of vitamin C will also cure tuberculosis by removal of the organism's polysaccharide coat. This was the same assertion made by Klenner when vitamin C was used to cure a pneumococcal infection. While a fairly large amount of research has been done on the effects of vitamin C in both human and animal tuberculosis, the doses of vitamin C used never resulted in what could be considered a cure for well-established cases of pulmonary tuberculosis. However, a significant amount of early research showed that vitamin C was capable of effectively controlling both the clinical aspects of tuberculosis infections as well as the actual growth of the tuberculosis bacteria. At the very least, it would seem that adequate doses of vitamin C can be expected to put most active cases of tuberculosis into a contained, latent phase. Such contained cases of tuberculosis can be expected to have little adverse effect on long-term health as long as daily vitamin C dosing remains adequate. Osborne and Geer made the simple observation that mammals lacking the ability to synthesize vitamin C were the same mammals most susceptible to bovine and human tuberculosis bacteria infections. These mammals were identified as man, monkey, and guinea pig. This simple fact also explains why so much of the tuberculosis research has utilized human and guinea pig subjects. A number of early researchers looked at the effects of vitamin C on tuberculosis patients. Even though the doses were generally very small, positive benefits were still often seen. Petter treated both tuberculosis adults and children with an oral dose of only 150 milligrams vitamin C daily. Even this small dosage was noted to definitely improve 30 of the 49 adults treated, 61%. Of the 24 children treated, 21, 88%, were felt to have improved on the same dosage. The better improvement among the children can be explained by the fixed dosage of vitamin C having a greater effect in a smaller body. Petter also noted improvement in the weight and general condition of the responding children. Another investigator, Albrecht, gave only 100 milligrams of vitamin C, although by injection, to his patients, and noted positive responses in temperature, weight, general well-being, appetite, and some blood tests. Bakhsh and Rabbani also had good results giving tuberculosis patients from 150 to 200 milligrams of oral vitamin C daily for 6 weeks. They also gave an additional 500 milligrams of vitamin C intramuscularly each day for the first 4 days of treatment. The researchers concluded that vitamin C was a valuable added treatment when there was low vitamin C excretion in the urine. They also noted that patients with pre-existing anemia generally responded with an increase in the blood count. The sedimentation rate, a test that can indicate the level of inflammation activity associated with infection, was lowered in more than half of the vitamin C-treated patients. Heise et al. Found that the intravenous administration of vitamin C often reduced an elevated sedimentation rate. Hasselbach reported seeing some positive effects from the administration of 100 milligrams of vitamin C daily. Hasselbach also advocated vitamin C as a tonic in tuberculosis patients, noting favorable results in certain forms of pulmonary hemorrhage. Radford et al. Studied 111 tuberculosis patients described as having far advanced disease. In addition to having vitamin C untreated control patients, they administered either orange juice or 250 milligrams of vitamin C in an orange-flavored drink. Generally, both the orange juice group and the vitamin C-supplemented orange drink group showed a more favorable response clinically, as judged by red blood cell count, hemoglobin level, and several other blood tests. Herford, in studying 66 cases of tuberculosis, found 64% of them to be suffering from vitamin C deficiency, as determined by urinary vitamin C excretion. Of 42 patients treated with vitamin C, 7 who suffered from anemia were felt to show a significant improvement. Babur looked at 74 patients with tuberculosis and found that the vitamin C-treated patients showed a marked increase in hemoglobin content and red blood cell counts. Dosage levels were only 200 milligrams orally in 4 divided doses daily for a period of 10 weeks. Rudra and Roy looked at the effects of giving 250 milligrams of oral vitamin C daily over a 10-week period to patients with pulmonary tuberculosis. After reviewing before and after blood tests on the white and red blood cell counts, they concluded that the additional vitamin C appeared to have improved the overall blood picture of the treated patients. Based on this improvement, they also suggested that a large intake of vitamin C by patients with pulmonary tuberculosis would be likely to increase resistance to infection. Some insight as to the effects of much larger doses of vitamin C on tuberculosis was submitted by Sharpie. Although the dosing was not nearly the equivalent of Klenner-sized dosing, Sharpie did give 15,000 milligrams of vitamin C daily to 6 very advanced tuberculosis patients. As the selected patients were already considered terminal, one patient died before the test was even significantly underway. However, the other 5 patients were still alive a half year later, gaining anywhere from 20 to 70 pounds in the process. They were no longer bedridden, and they were generally considered to have undergone an enormous degree of improvement in their general condition. Although Sharpie noted that the tuberculosis lesions had not resolved during the treatment period, he commented that the patients seemed to be unaware of the enormous tuberculosis lesions they harbored. He also commented that the total vitamin C dosing was roughly 3 million milligrams per patient, and there was no evidence of any toxicity or side effect. As mentioned earlier in this section, it would appear that the administration of enough vitamin C can certainly be expected to enable a tuberculosis patient to coexist with the chronic infection in an overall healthy manner. It should also be noted that tuberculosis lesions in the lung of an advanced patient destroy a significant amount of lung tissue, resulting in a scarred appearance on the chest X-ray. Since scarring would remain even if every tubercular organism was eradicated in a long-infected patient, a normal chest X-ray examination would never result. McCormick described one case of active tuberculosis treated with vitamin C. A dose of 1,000 milligrams was given intravenously, either daily or every other day, for a period of 3 weeks. This intravenous regimen was combined with 500 milligrams of oral vitamin C, along with a large amount of citrus juices. McCormick noted that the temperature was reduced and maintained at a normal level from the outset of treatment. Furthermore, the patient completely stopped having the characteristic tuberculosis cough and the associated coughing up of the accumulated products of the tuberculosis infection in the lungs. In addition, the patient gained about 10 pounds over the treatment period. It should also be noted that traditional anti-tuberculosis drugs are given for years. No traditional form of tuberculosis treatment is ever prescribed for only a few weeks or even months. Like any other anti-tuberculosis drug, vitamin C needs to be given to the tuberculosis patient for life, with the extra high dosing extending for a year or more. It must be kept in mind that the tubercular organisms grow very slowly, and any form of therapy will not show dramatic changes over a short period of treatment. This is in direct contrast to the vitamin C or antibiotic treatment of many of the other more acute infectious diseases. As was noted earlier, pulmonary tuberculosis is typically characterized by the coughing up of bright red blood or blood-streaked sputum. Whenever bright red blood appears in any context, there is a general assumption that some degree of acute hemorrhage, however localized, has occurred. Borsellino, in working with 140 tuberculosis patients, found that injections of 100 milligrams of vitamin C were able to rapidly control the coughing up of blood, presumably by strengthening the capillaries in the lungs. Furthermore, this symptom regularly reappeared once the vitamin C treatment was discontinued. One interpretation of this response is that pulmonary tuberculosis includes a state of focal scurvy in the capillaries of affected areas of the lungs, This focal scurvy directly facilitates the rupture of capillaries as they lose their structural integrity, resulting in the coughing up of blood. Also, just as with generalized scurvy, administering vitamin C produces a very rapid and positive clinical response in the stopping of this focal bleeding. The effects of vitamin C on some of the non-pulmonary forms of tuberculosis have also been studied. Vitorero and Doyle reported positive benefits in the vitamin C treatment of intestinal tuberculosis. Their initial regimen was the injection of 500 to 600 milligrams of vitamin C daily, with gradual reductions to 400 milligrams daily and finally 200 milligrams daily as improvement was demonstrated. Bogan et al. Looked at the response of tuberculosis lesions to vitamin C therapy in different mucous membranes. They found that only 150 milligrams of vitamin C supplemented daily with whatever was already present in the diet appeared to have a beneficial effect on tuberculous lesions that could be visualized in the respiratory passages, intestines, and rectum. This was in spite of the fact that the general condition of the lung involvement from the tuberculosis showed little difference. As with many other diseases, researchers have also determined that tuberculosis patients generally have lower levels of vitamin C. This is an additional argument that all tuberculosis patients should be supplemented regularly with vitamin C, with only the amount remaining in question. Pleat et al. Found that tuberculosis patients had persistent evidence of ongoing oxidative stress, which consumes vitamin C at greater than normal rates, even after 6 months of apparently successful antimicrobial therapy. Faulkner and Taylor, looking at two patients with active tuberculosis, found that roughly three times more vitamin C than normal was required to maintain normal plasma levels and urinary excretion levels of vitamin C. Furthermore, they found the same increased vitamin C needs applied to two other patients, one with rheumatic fever and one with lung abscess, indicating the increased utilization of vitamin C in other infections as well. Abbasi et al. And Chang and Lan not only noted lowered urinary excretion of vitamin C in their tuberculosis patients, but they also saw that the patients with the most clinically active disease had the lowest vitamin C levels in the urine. Banerjee et al. Also noted lower urinary vitamin C excretion in acute tuberculosis patients. In a study on Navajo Indians with tuberculosis, P. Hoan and Sedlacek concluded that a minimum of twice as much vitamin C was needed on a daily basis by the tuberculosis patients to maintain the same plasma levels as normal subjects. Yetter and Bumbelow, in examining the excretion of vitamin C in the urine, found that 37 out of 37 children with active tuberculosis were suffering from vitamin C deficiency. They logically concluded that vitamin C supplementation in such patients would seem advisable. In another publication, Bumbelow and Yetter noted that vitamin C supplementation raised the urinary excretion of vitamin C in children with tuberculosis a small amount, but not nearly to the levels of their normal control children. Stopping the supplementation promptly dropped the urinary excretion to pre-treatment levels. They concluded that hypovitaminosis C was a part of active tuberculosis, and increased vitamin C intake was an indicated therapeutic measure. Bumbelow also concluded that there is probably some vitamin C deficiency in all forms of tuberculosis in children. Babur, in treating 74 tuberculosis patients, also found that the vast majority of patients treated had low plasma concentrations of vitamin C. Furthermore, plasma levels were highest after a full 10 weeks of oral supplementation, giving further support to the need for prolonged, lifelong supplementation in such a chronic infection as tuberculosis. Goetz and Kerner also noted lower blood vitamin C levels in their tuberculosis patients. In patients with tuberculosis involvement of the intestines, Dubé et al. found that both plasma and white blood cell levels of vitamin C were significantly lowered, and the urinary excretion of vitamin C was also markedly decreased, presumably representing an attempt to conserve the depleted vitamin C stores remaining in the body. In tuberculosis,